Won't you?
Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
We tend to forget that people, even in high-status professions like doctors and lawyers, are human beings. Just because they're smart and have a lot of education doesn't mean they don't have feelings. They don't have insecurities. It doesn't mean that they're unlikely to succumb to life's pressures. I've been doing some research and found that 50%, this is amazing to me, 50% of doctors now report feeling burned out. And according to the American Bar Association, one in four lawyers suffers from clinical depression or anxiety. More than this is amazing. More than half of lawyers say they wouldn't choose to be a lawyer again. And substance abuse among doctors and lawyers is crazy. It's very high. According to the American Bar Association, again, as many as, and that's a little fudge word they use, so I don't know exactly what it means, but as many as one in three lawyers is a, quote, problem drinker. And when you think about it, it's not surprising. Doctors are dealing with life and death issues every day, like non-compliant patients, Medicare and insurance companies that micromanage doctors, refuse to cover treatments that they deem unworthy. And lawyers, they're facing ever greater stress. We've got an oversupply of lawyers, so it's hard to get and keep a good job. They seem ever more shark-like. It used to be this profession of this kind of honorable profession, but nobody talks about, you know, lawyers being, you know, honorable. I'm sure there are plenty of still who are, but it feels more shark-like. I have a lot of my most frequent clients are lawyers and doctors that are unhappy. And they're talking about how sleazy and how what they will, there's ever greater temptations to do whatever it takes to win or to make their billable hour quota. And nowhere is that pressure greater than in the trial lawyer. And Gary William, who is the guy who's tried the most plaintiff cases in jury trials in Contra Costa in history, 180 jury trials to verdict, including a number of multimillion-dollar verdicts, including $6 million over GM and $337 million verdict over Bechtel. Even he succumbed. This guy also, he was the president of the Public Justice Foundation, president of the Consumer Attorneys of California, twice nominated trial lawyer of the year. And yet, as you're going to hear, he succumbed big time to the pressures of being a lawyer. He wrote a book about it, which in his preface he says it tells the whole truth and nothing but the truth. It's called Getting a Winning Verdict in My Personal Life. Gary William, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thanks, Marty. It's a real pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Good. Well, paint a picture of how the stress wore you down bit by bit.
Well, what you just said about the importance of winning was certainly a big part of it. I am a courtroom lawyer. From the very beginning of the day I walked out of law school, all I did was take cases to trial, first as a prosecutor, second as a plaintiff's lawyer and a trial lawyer. And day after day, week after week, the stress got higher. Don't forget, Marty, that I didn't get anything. I had to take something away from somebody to win. First their liberty, then their money. People don't like that. I fought the biggest corporations, insurance companies around, the very best lawyers. And fighting that fight day in and day out finally kind of got to me.
And walk me through the baby steps. You didn't suddenly collapse. Walk me through the baby steps of the decline and fall of Gary William.
Well, we can talk a lot about my tendency towards alcoholism. We can get into that a little later. But in terms of what happened, I just found that the grind of day in and day out trial, I was a functioning alcoholic. I didn't have a bottle in my desk or anything, but I went from wanting a drink to needing a drink. And I began to use drinking, which I'd always loved drinking, so I was a loved social drinker of the first order. But I began to find that I was relying on alcohol to reduce my stress, which turned out to be a terrible mistake.
And some people have a tremendous, you know, alcohol is a drug that gives them such pleasure, and others, frankly, it doesn't do a thing for me. Why? Can you explain? This is my ignorance. Explain, what do you think is the causal inference? What causes all the differences between us?
Well, I think some of it is biological for sure. I loved the very first time I took a drink, Marty, when I was 16 years old at a party and I took a beer or two and beer and got that high feeling. I loved it. I loved drinking. I never really wanted to quit drinking because I enjoyed it. I enjoyed that feeling. It gave me a freedom. I was maybe a little shy between it, and I would feel like I was socially coming out. I felt better. I felt like I was better looking. I felt like women liked me better. All of this stuff was the seduction of the drink, but I loved it.
You said you thought it was biological. Explain that.
Well, I come from a long line of alcoholics. My father was an alcoholic, my grandfather, my uncle. All the men in my family were alcoholics.
You're Irish, not that it's a stereotype,
well,
you don't want, but is that right? Is
primarily
that...
Welsh. William is a Welsh name, but I have Irish in me, I have English, I have the Northern European stuff. But I definitely had a long line of alcoholism in my history, and I knew that. But you know what? I wasn't worried about that. Do you know why?
Tell me.
Because I was smarter than all my ancestors. None of them had gone to college. I was the first one. And I was arrogant as hell, pardon my French, about thinking that I was too smart to really be an alcoholic. I was a lawyer. How could I be an alcoholic? And when I really realized that that's what I was, it was a real comeuppance and a fundamental change in who I was.
How did you realize it? Was there a moment you, quote, realized it?
Yeah, let me tell you a story if you have a minute. My drinking was getting serious and more and more serious as time went on, and I hit my 40s, and as I moved into my 40s, the alcohol was catching up with me. I was finding that I didn't tolerate it as well. I needed more to make it work right, and in a lot of different ways it was beating me down. I also wasn't doing very well at home. I was in my second marriage. I was out staying out too late and getting out socializing because I wanted to drink all the time. That I'm not proud of, but that was catching up with me, and my marriage was on the rocks. So something very important happened to me, an event that I will never forget, if I can go ahead. In my book, I have a chapter entitled Burning Out in the Fast Lane, and I talk about what was going on in a little more detail than I did here, but the next chapter is called The Intervention. Here's what happened. It was a Saturday night. It was June 11th, 1984. And my wife said, we're going to go out to dinner with some friends across the bay, friends I like, drinking buddies. They drank. And so we said we were going to meet at a hotel down on Hagenberger Road near the airport in Oakland. That was great. And we were supposed to meet at 5:30, which was a little early, but that's great, too, because it gives a little more time to go to the bar and drink. So we walked into the hotel, when I came in, I turned right to go into the bar because that's obviously where we're going to meet him. And Liz, my wife at the time, took my arm and says, no, we're meeting him in the coffee shop. And I said to myself, coffee shop? And we walked into the coffee shop. There wasn't anybody in the coffee shop except one table way back at the back. There were four guys there. Liz guided me over to him. I looked at him. One of them was my former partner. One of them was a guy I knew a little bit. One of them was somebody I didn't know, and I had a rising level of concern about this. And I turned to Liz, and I said, well, what's this about? She says, these guys want to talk to you about drinking. I said, great. I love talking about drinking. Let's go to the bar. Why are we in the coffee shop talking about drinking? Well, that wasn't what they wanted. So, Marty, what happened is they set me down and went around the table and told me that I was drinking too much. They were worried about me. It was coming back on me in a lot of different ways. My reputation was suffering. And it was very demeaning, very upsetting. And I knew Liz was upset with me, maybe getting ready to leave me. But I got angry. I turned to them after a few minutes and I said, I want to ask you a question. Any of you getting better verdicts than I am? Because I knew they weren't. Because I was still functioning pretty well. I said, what the hell right do you have to tell me that I'm drinking too much? It's none of your damn business. You can go to hell. So I stood up and took Liz and went out, and we drove home in stony silence. Marty, you'll have to appreciate this, the arrogance I had. We walk into the house. It's about 6:30. And I turn to my wife and I say, well, you don't expect me not to have a drink after that, do you? Like, poor Gary deserves a drink because people are telling me that I'm an alcoholic. So I went into the front room, poured myself a scotch, sat down, and Liz walked into the other room. I could hear her crying. She was in her bedroom. I knew she was getting ready to leave me. I had two kids, 7 and 9. I loved them, my two daughters. The drink didn't taste very good. I started to drink a second one. Now, keep in mind, Marty, I drank every day for 25 years. Never quit once. Never said I was going to quit. And that second drink, I couldn't finish it. I walked into the bedroom, and I turned to Liz, and I said, I'm going to tell you something I've never said before. I know you're going to leave me. I'm going to stop drinking right now. And do you know why I did that? Because I felt like I had been slapped in the face. The arrogance of me had really been exposed, and it was so embarrassing to have to go through that that I could not deny anymore that I needed to stop. I knew I needed to stop, but this set me over the edge. That sent me on a path where I really ended up quitting drinking.
So what I found, of course, I love the story, but what I found interesting is what really was the trigger was embarrassment. Is that right?
Embarrassment and the fact that I knew that my wife was going to leave me, and I'd been kind of procrastinating on that. And I think knowing that and knowing the fact that, there was embarrassment and I needed some humility. I mean, I had been a little arrogant. And, it was. I felt like I'd been slapped in the face. The public humility.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. I'm talking with Gary Gwilliam. He is an eminent attorney. He has tried more jury trials to verdict as a plaintiff's lawyer than anybody in the Bay Area. And he has won a $337 million verdict from Bechtel and a $6 million verdict from General Motors. And yet even he, who was a functioning alcoholic, was a total in his personal life and in other things. What did the people in the confrontation, in the intervention, what did they say to you in response? Like, yeah, you won those trials, but what were you really like?
Well, they were compassionate, and I must say this was an early intervention in 1984. They're much better now. They've learned a lot about them. It turned out that the guy that was my best friend was one of the fellows there, and he'd founded the Other Bar, which is the organization for lawyers in the Bay and in California. That's a very nice. His name's Ed Caldwell. Unfortunately, he died last year. What a great guy he was. And we became very best friends. And he told the story time and time again later about how this was his worst failure, that all of a sudden this thing turned out to be a failure. And he didn't know for a while that he'd actually sent me on the path to stopping drinking. But we ended up lecturing, and I've told this story many, many times with him and without him to lawyers throughout the state and throughout the country as an example of how we can make a change.
But you didn't answer the question. What was it? You know, I want our listeners who may be having a substance abuse problem to be able to see in themselves the behaviors that, you know, what did they say? Well, you know, you told me that at the intervention they said, you know, you may win the cases, but you this and you that. And you, what were the you this and you that's that they said to you?
Well, they didn't argue with me about winning the cases. It wasn't about
right.
that. They said, Gary, you know, everybody knows that you're drinking too much. Your partners are worried about you. They weren't there. Your friends are worried about you. Your wife, okay. I am. And all of a sudden, you know, I thought that I could go out and drink and pass out and get stupid at these parties, and people didn't pay any attention.
I see.
But I was kidding myself that I was making a bigger fool of myself than I realized.
What were you like at home? What were you like with Liz? What made her want to leave you?
Too many late nights, too many BS stories, just not, I wasn't doing well, and she knew that I was falling apart, but I knew she loved me, and fortunately, this saved our marriage for a while, and when we did finally separate, and we did later, we separated on good terms, and I loved her till the day she died. And
so it didn't, but that, it wasn't just like that intervention was an instant path out. Walk me through what went on from that intervention moving forward to where you to today.
Let me just step back a little bit. I knew I had a drinking problem. I'd been to some counseling. My doctor told me my liver was not functioning well. I knew I had a drinking problem, but I did not want to quit. I was afraid to quit, and I'll tell you why. Because every single thing I had ever done in my life that had been fun and involved alcohol, from parties when I was a kid to trial lawyer functions? How the hell could I go to a Raider game and not drink beer? How could I go out with the guys and play dominoes or bridge and not drink? How could I particularly go to a party and not drink? All the things that I liked involved drinking. So I said to myself, or I felt this way, if I stop drinking, I'll never have fun again. That turned out not to be true. Not only could I have fun, I could remember it.
How did you change? What, again, I'm interested in my listeners learning lessons from you, whether they're lawyers or doctors or clerks. What worked for you in helping you to internally accept that you could have fun, indeed perhaps more fun, like you said, and remember it, by if you didn't drink? What worked?
Well, first of all, when I really quit, I began to feel better immediately. My doctor told me he thought I might go through the DTs. I was seeing a psychiatrist. But I didn't, and I realized I hadn't really had a lot of hangovers because I was able to deal with them. I took Alka-Seltzer. Maybe that was a problem. But my mind cleared up a little bit, and I found that I was able to function more in the evenings. I could read. I could stay up. I felt like I was operating just at a lot, feeling a lot better.
I'd like to go to the phones. Dear listeners, if you or someone you care about either currently is suffering from a substance abuse problem, and I don't care what the substance is. It could be alcohol. It could be pot. It could be crack. If you or the drug of the hot drug these days, believe it or not, is heroin. And so if you or someone you care about has got a substance problem or had a substance problem and have a question or comment from my guest, Gary Gwilliam, eminent trial attorney and author of the book, Getting a Winning Verdict in My Personal Life, I invite you to call. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Gary, now let's turn to the concept of prevention. If somebody is out there and they feel vulnerable, some people are just not susceptible to addictions. But if someone is susceptible to addictions, exacerbated by the stress of their job, whatever it is, what advice would you give if it was me and I'm your brother? What do you tell me?
Well, I think that the question I'm often asked and I think a lot about is, when are you a social drinker and when do you turn into a problem drinker? And I'm interested in that point. Now, a lot of people are interested in the later point of how you really take care of yourself when you're down in the dumps. And I think that the key point to me, and it's with so many people I've known, is that when you begin to need a drink and you take a drink for stress, and that's not drinking for fun anymore. You feel like you kind of need a drink, and maybe you need that second drink. And it's a matter of kind of taking, being aware of yourself and asking yourself this. I give a talk to lawyers occasionally called, Am I Drinking Too Much? Is a rhetorical question. We lawyers like that. Rhetorical questions means it answers itself. So if you look in the mirror and say, I wonder if I'm drinking too much, you ought to be aware of that. And you ought not to just blow it off and say, well, that's not that big a problem. It is a problem, and it's true of any substance. Am I overdoing it?
Isn't there a spiritual... I know you, in your book and in our conversation before the show, you talk about a spiritual component in the prevention aspect of it. And it's in how you deal with losses. Everybody has losses, whether you're a lawyer or not. What have you... Is some aspect of how you take life's lumps an attitude toward critical, toward preventing descending into alcoholism or any kind of substance abuse?
Well, in the first chapter of my book, I deal with the nadir of my career and a very major case that I lost, and it shocked me, and I think that really kind of exacerbated my drinking because I didn't know how to deal with that loss other than to take the pain of that loss and to anesthetize it with alcohol, and that's what we're doing. Whether we're going through a divorce, whether somebody dies in our family, whether we suffer a serious loss or a financial loss, we tend to want to use alcohol as an easy way for an anesthetic to avoid that pain. But it's very deceptive. It gets worse. It doesn't help it. It only helps it temporarily, and then things get worse down the line when you continue to drink and you fall into alcoholism.
I want to stay on that issue of dealing with the lumps. Let's say today you're still practicing, you know, attorney. Let's say you lost. How would your either behavior or psychological attitude or spiritual belief, how would your mindset be different today if you lost a big case against GM than it was 30 years ago?
Well, I've written about that. I'm one of the few lawyers in the entire country that's ever written about losses. That's verboten. That's taboo. We don't talk about losing. You know, Jerry Spence never lost a case. I like Jerry. He's a very fine lawyer.
Been a guest on this show.
One of the best. But he has an attitude that, you know, you just win-win. But you don't win. And young lawyers particularly lose cases. When we tried as many cases as I did before the 80s and 90s, when we've tried significantly fewer cases, I think we rolled with the losses a little better. But I think the whole concept of winning, which you mentioned a little bit in your introduction, has become so important to us that these losses we take seem to be much more serious for us nowadays than they used to. So, I've written an article called The Art of Losing and another one called Lessons from Losing, which are similar concepts, and that is that sometimes we have to understand that losses help us to understand and get more deeply into what we're doing. And what are the lessons from losing? Humility, compassion, courage to step forward and take another case, and most importantly, forgiveness.
I would think forgiveness. Why forgiveness?
Forgiveness of yourself.
Okay, yes.
Not only forgiveness of the jury that ruled against you or the lousy defense attorney you hated or the judge that made bad rulings, but understanding that, you know, we can't be perfect. And when somebody loses a case, they hold themselves up to a much higher standard than everybody else does because we don't think we're ever supposed to lose cases. And there's a sense of shame, not guilt, a sense of shame about a loss that can be very real and very painful.
Before I became a career counselor, I would have thought the following would help, but I found with my clients it hasn't, and I'm curious if you agree. The notion of having perspective. You know, you're generally fighting for, you know, it's not always a little old lady. More often than not, it's one company fighting against another to get some money goes to one company versus the other. Does a sense of perspective, a cosmic, I love the word cosmic, sense of perspective, that in the end, it just doesn't matter that much. Whether it's the, you know, you've done your best, you do what you can, and then, you know, you're only going to be worse as a lawyer or whatever you're doing if you let it get to you, say, you know what, it wasn't meant to be, I did my best, it's in the cosmic scheme of things, it ain't that big a deal, I'm moving on. My clients have not found that useful generally. Do you find that concept useful in your mind or not useful?
I think perspective really only comes with experience. And when you've been through it and done it a lot, I think you gain perspective. I think people that have not really had that much experience oftentimes don't. And secondly, I don't know that you can intellectualize this and talk about it. I think it's something where you really have to get in touch with your feelings and maybe do some counseling and some work. And I think all of us can benefit sometimes from getting a little help and talking to somebody who's a professional about how we deal with these issues.
I want to ask you that question about feeling. You know, lawyers tend to be highly intellectualized. I want you not to feel you need to be smart or intellectual right now. You're not a kid anymore. And you've had a long career, like I said, 180 jury trials, more than anybody in the Bay Area. How do you feel about your life as a trial lawyer?
I've loved being a lawyer. It has sustained me. I'm one of the few people that has really loved going to work every single day. Part of it is because I have choice. I have a good firm. I've done what I wanted to do. And there's a lot of different readings. So you ask me how I feel about it. I feel like I'm one of these people that found the right profession for me. I think it sustained me. It continues to sustain me. Theoretically, I'm of retirement age, but I love going to work. I'm still in the game. I'm still operating at high performance levels and tend to continue to do so. So my feelings about the law and what I've done are very good. But like you said earlier, I'm the exception, not the rule. And so many of my friends and colleagues and people that I know and don't know are struggling with this difficult, conflictual profession we're in.
Yeah, and if there is tremendous, in the introduction of the show, the amount of alcoholism and stress, and these days it's not so easy. We send so many people to law school because there was so many, when the economy is bad, we go to school hoping that if we get another degree, we're going to be able to prevail. But there's a hell of a lot of lawyers who are working as paralegals or legal secretaries or not even working as lawyers at all, so it's terrible. So let's pretend that I am your son. Let's say I'm 20 years old, and I am, say, sophomore, junior in college. What? And I say, Dad, I'm thinking about becoming a lawyer. What are some of the thoughts you would have for me or ask me?
Well, I think you ought to ask yourself, obviously, why. And I think one of the things that's a mistake is that if you think you're going to be a lawyer to make a lot of money And you think of that, that's one thing. Secondly, I think that we see a lot of romanticism in the media and lawyers and these cases that these programs are on about lawyers. People think that they're going to do justice and go out and do good work and do the work that they see on TV. You have to recognize that that's very likely not to happen. The vast majority of lawyers go to work for big firms. They become part of a cog in a corporation. They need to do that to make money. And, of course, nowadays, as you well know, you're going to come out of law school with a hell of a lot of debt, and you're going to have to pay that off, which means that maybe you've got to take a job you don't like. So you end up pushing a lot of paper, working for people you don't like and don't respect, maybe insurance companies or toxic looters or people that are doing wrong.
It's really, everybody goes to law school wanting to, you know, change the world and, you know, make it, quote, better, work for the little guy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there are relatively few of those jobs, and most of those, there's a lot of that's pro bono work. So that's the reality. Is that a fair summary?
I think so. And I think that if they go into it with their eyes open, that this is something that's, and law school's a grind. And taking the bar exam is no fun. California's a tough bar exam. Oftentimes 50% or more fail the bar exam. So they're launching into something that if you're going to do it, you better be serious and dedicated and know what you're getting into, because it's going to be a serious commitment.
What's one other thing, if I'm your son and I'm deliberating this, what's one other thing you want to tell me that maybe you would only tell a son or daughter? Of course, excuse me, I didn't, you know, just because I'm a guy, I said son, but it could, of course, could apply to a daughter.
Well, if it were my case, and none of my kids became lawyers, incidentally, and none of them were even vaguely interested in being lawyers from what they saw with the stress that it had on me.
Right.
They saw the stress that it had and how it affected me, at least in the times that before I quit drinking. Well, I think that you know, you'd have to ask yourself, don't just look at the great things in the cases you won and think that it's all going to be roses. We are in a profession where we're in conflict all the time. You have to learn to live with conflict. You're fighting with somebody on every single case, just about. Now, maybe some transactional work that's not quite as much, but family law is terrible. Mm-hmm. Criminal law is terrible. I don't do either one of those. My work is tough enough, fighting with insurance companies and big people and big corporations and the work I do, but there's just a lot of work that's very, very difficult work.
So how do you deal with right now? How do you deal with stress in your job?
Well, boy, you know, I've handled it so much better in different ways because I've learned to think about it. I've wrote about it in my book.
Specifically, what do you do?
Well, specifically, I first of all, I take care of myself. Obviously, I don't drink. I meditate. I find time to be with myself. And I think there's just an experience level of just rolling with it and dealing with it. I see my younger partners. And I don't have a big firm. There's only six of us, but I see them struggling a little bit with that, and I can understand how it was there. But I think at this stage of the game, what happened to me, Marty, is at some stage, particularly after I quit drinking, I pretty much lost the fear. I lost the fear of losing. I lost the fear of maybe things aren't going to go right for me. And it may sound, I'm not trying to tell anybody that I don't have any fear. We all have fear. But my fear level is so much lower, and I've read a lot, I've worked a lot on myself, I went on this spiritual journey after I quit drinking. All of that, I think, brought me to a place where I feel very centered in my life, I feel happy in my life, and I am at a place where I'm not going to let stress get to me very much.
What's next? What's next for Gary Gwilliam?
Well, you know, I'm not going away from where I'm in the law. I've done writing, I've done lecturing, I've lectured on my book a lot. I'm interested in doing some talking about aging. Not just aging, but how can we operate at peak performance, at our highest level? Can we be the best we can still be in our 70s, for example, or maybe into our 80s? Marty, there were, my partner's name is Randy, you remind me of, there were the generation before us, before me, would never try cases after 65. That was just kind of done, just like, you know, there comes a time when you don't do surgery anymore for doctors and that sort of thing. That's changed. Now there's a whole bunch of us who are trying cases into our 70s and beyond because we're operating at higher levels later in life. That's just kind of what we are. The baby boomers have kind of brought us to that, and I think for a lot of reasons we're able to maintain a high level of performance much longer into life than we used to. And I'm interested in analyzing that from a lawyer's standpoint, and how can we continue to operate at peak performance in later years.
Do you have any intuition or insight? As you know, again, our listeners are probably, they perk up, whether you're, even if you're over 40, over 50, over 60, over 70, certainly, you would like to, you know, most people don't want to retire and play golf, that staging area for the hereafter. They would like to be, if you know, as close to their, because nobody wants to decline. Do you have any one insight that you'd like to share that might contribute to being able to be as fully functioning professionally as possible in our later years?
I'm not quite sure I agree with that. I think there are a lot of people who are ready to retire and walk away from their work. It depends mm-hmm. on how they feel about their work. Now, I'm in a profession that traditionally older people go into. Look at judges, and I'm in a profession that kind of caters to older people. So I think there are a lot of people that still want to do that and stay in it. But in my case, I've transitioned a bit so that I'm not just doing all the hard trial work. I'm delegating most of that work to younger people so that I can then move back and become more the mentor and the teacher and be involved in it less and less, so that I don't have to sit back and stay up till midnight grinding out and preparing for the next day. I can delegate some of that, and I think that helps a lot. It's if you can transition and begin to see yourself in a little different role than what I was. So I'm beginning to see myself not so much as a warrior, now more as a teacher, as a mentor, as something that's a little different than the warrior part of me that was a part of being a trialer for so long.
And Gary Gwilliam, thank you for mentoring us about the art of stress management and also opening our eyes to the fact that even, quote, esteemed professionals that we tend to idealize or think that are impervious are human beings. Gary Gwilliam is the author of Getting a Winning Verdict in My Personal Life. Thanks again for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemko.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Okay. Now, as usual, we turn to you, my dear listeners. If you have a career problem, either you're unemployed or well-employed and still unhappy, like so many lawyers, doctors, executives, college presidents, those folks do represent a large part of my career counseling practice. And believe me, even college presidents who are seen as like almost, you know, about as esteemed a profession as you're going to have, suffer lots of issues. I can usually be of help. The phone number here for what I call a workover, but no pummeling involved, here at KEOW and Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And this is a great time to call. Usually at the end of the show, the lines jam up, and then you have to wait, and you don't get on the air, and all the rest of it. So this is the time to call, 415-841-4134. And the calls are coming right in, and we'll go right to the phones, but I like to make the most of every minute so that you don't feel like you're wasting any time. Oh, we got a call already? Okay, let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It is your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hi, how are you?
I am well. What gives me the honor of the call?
Well. My name is Albert Fiorella, and I'm a marriage and family therapist in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
I have two distinct points that I wanted to mention. One is with your original question about 15 minutes ago, which had to do with substance abuse.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually recovered a heroin addict, mm-hmm. and I am now a marriage and family therapist, as I had said. But one of the things that I had learned, you'll have to bear with me here, is I made the conscious decision 4 years into my recovery to actually start socially drinking, believe it or not. And I've been doing that, and I haven't had a problem at all, and I've never reverted to my drug of choice. And when I was in graduate school, I wanted to explore this. And I had found that there was a litany of literature talking about a theory called desistance theory, why some people are able to walk away simply from substance abuse and alcohol addiction, and why others can't. And when I was doing my study, I had requested to speak with individuals who were addicted to drugs and alcohol, got clean, and then were able to live a life where they were actually socially drinking, let's say, so to speak. And that's when I came across this theory called desistance theory. There's actually a graph of different drugs that are inherently addictive, like methamphetamine, crack, heroin. Those are inherently addictive. Alcohol, you actually really have to work at to get addicted to. It's actually quite difficult, believe it or not. And I've been happy and been fine ever since. Now, do I go look for it? No. Am I a fall-down drunk? Absolutely not. Do I drink every day? Probably twice a month, maybe, with dinner. But it was something that I started to look at, and I had found that, you know, not everything that you read or hear is the absolute truth.
You said you had a second point. Well, so your first point basically is that just because you quit one substance doesn't mean it, and you're addiction prone doesn't mean you can't use moderation in some other substance. What was your second point?
Right. Well, I just wanted to mention because your guest is a trial attorney. My father was a very well known trial attorney in New York. He actually did the Agent Orange litigation. Back in the late 70s and early 80s, and he was a man who was consumed with his profession. I actually think that his drug of choice was being a trial attorney, and he was what was called like a hired gun. He would take, you know, less than 10% of cases are actually tried before a jury or a judge, for that matter. And so other attorneys who were not as familiar with trying cases before the bench or before a jury would hire my father to try the cases for them, because he was such a great trial attorney. When I asked him, when I told him that I wanted to be a lawyer, he actually went out of his way to dissuade both me and my brother from becoming attorneys. He had said the profession had changed in his generation, and that there were very few people at the top of the profession and a whole bunch of mediocre, you know, attorneys at the bottom, and a lot of people trying to find work as attorneys. You know, and I just wanted to mention that because I, you know, just to piggyback on the comment that your guest had made.
Yep. There are very few fields where it's, you know, really easy to get a good job, or very few fields where everybody's a star. There is that, you know, the 80-20 rule. 20% of the people get 80% of the business. 20% of the people are really super, stand above the rest. In every, you know, in height, there's always going to be a few people who are a whole lot taller than the average. There is just,
right.
You know, there's a normal distribution of people. Anyway, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
Right. And if you, I'm really particularly interested in helping you solve a problem rather than, you know, you're welcome to share, that's fine. But if you've got a work-related problem of any sort, whether you're 16 or 76, whether you are a clerk or a CEO, for-profit or non-profit, the price is certainly right. Zero, zippo, nada. What's that the price for? A workover here on Work with Marty Nemco, where I try to help you or someone you care about with a work-related problem. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And one of the things that I've helped a number of my clients do who are not doctors or lawyers or whatever is help people start businesses. And I have found that in the real world, what it really takes more often than not to succeed in business is the opposite of what an MBA program teaches you. So I'll give a couple of you. I've got callers on the line, but I'm going to give one example, and then we'll do more later. Business schools are always saying innovate. That is very risky advice in the real world. Of course, a large company can take risks. It's got deep pockets. It can stay in business even if it's tried a lot of different things and only 1 out of 10 succeed. But a small business, you're likely to run out of money. And that's the end. That's your money is the lifeblood of a business. And there are so many reasons why an innovation might fail. The development costs of your brilliant app or your product are too high. And they're subject to overruns. You estimated in your little nice little business plan it's going to cost, you know, $50,000 to develop it, and in the end it costs $100,000, and now you're broke. Or the product doesn't work. Or the public doesn't like it. You loved it, and that's what drove you. You loved it, and you failed the basic rule of business 101, talk to your customers. Instead, you say, well, I think I love my lemon curd, so everybody else is going to love it too. Right? Or the public too quickly stops liking it because some behemoth corporation comes up with a lemon curd that's a lot better and a lot cheaper. Or, I mean, and that really is why they often say the leading edge so often turns out to be the bleeding edge. Of course, it's fun to innovate, and the world benefits from innovation. We feel more alive and creative if we're innovating. But if you don't have the deep pockets to afford the multiple failures that usually precede even most successful entrepreneur success, it's wiser to replicate a successful type of business than to innovate. One of my favorite phrases is don't innovate, replicate. And it's much easier to find a successful business to replicate in the small retail space. And small means it's affordable. If there is a reasonable percentage of small retailers in a certain category are busy, it's a sign that's a viable business. We're living in an ever more Latino society, and so burrito places are if they're good, are you often see a line even in front of a Roach Coach, one of those taco trucks. So if I were trying to start that kind of business, I would simply watch the busy ones, look at their menu, look at their, you know, how they serve people, how they get it done quickly, where are the ovens set up, what are the items on them, what are the pricing, where is its location. I play detective. I visit maybe five busy Roach Coaches, and I say, what are the best ideas from all of them? They're there for me to see. That's what the beauty of trying to imitate a retail business. And then I incorporate the best of all five of those in an awesome location. Can you see how my odds of succeeding are going to be far greater at something like that than if I tried to innovate and come up with a new food sensation? Don't innovate, replicate. All right, now we can go to the phones. I'll give out the phone number again. If you or someone you care about has a work-related problem, for a work over the phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. To the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. How can I help you? Hello, it's you.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, hear me.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Yes, hi. My name is Larry. I'm 35, working at a tech company in the Bay Area, and a job I really enjoy quite a bit. But I'm also a recent father, a first-time father of a beautiful little girl, and I'm finding myself now, 6 months on, torn between the time I spend at a job that I enjoy and the time that I'm losing with my daughter. And I'm curious if you or your listening group have advice.
Absolutely. You know, there is, especially in the Silicon Valley culture and in many workplaces, especially with all the sword of Damocles hanging over your head that they'll offshore your job or automate it or hire somebody younger at half the salary, there's a tendency to want to work your way into job security and work 70 hours a week. But if you're any good, and you say if you love it, usually if you say if you love it, you're probably pretty good at it. What I would encourage you to do is set your boundaries. I would have a heart-to-heart with my boss and say, you are facing this catch-22. On the one hand, you're afraid that if you devote too much time to your lovely, beautiful, and of course today we can't call them just beautiful daughters, we must make sure we call them smart and spunky and perky and plucky and all the rest of it. But if you say, I would like to spend time with my daughter, but I also am very committed to doing an excellent job for you, can we discuss what are realistic work expectations for me so that I don't feel like I'm at the risk of losing my job and yet I am still going to be there somewhat for my daughter? Is that something you think you could, that open conversation, asking for what you want in a polite, balanced way, is that
Certainly.
Something you could
and
have?
In fact, I've had that conversation. I'm lucky enough to have an organization that I think recognizes the need for those boundaries. I think where I found myself struggling is I do some freelance work on the side that does not pay in near the same terms as my job does now, but would allow me to work from home. And I'm trying to determine, you know, where does the, not necessarily what does the next several years look like, but am I pursuing a job that is going to permanently keep me from spending the amount of time with my family
when I
that
was
I would
you.
Want versus yeah. do I take the risk and pursue a freelance or entrepreneurial self-employed role that may be a little bit harder to do but would give me much more flexibility and time with my family.
Of course, you know, everybody is different. When I was younger, though, I would have encouraged the entrepreneurial route. There's so much more upside potential. You have control of your life or whatever. But I found that most people who are self-employed take a million more hours because there isn't that infrastructure, the IT infrastructure, the HR infrastructure, the accounting infrastructure. You need help. You need, you know, it ends up being a bigger time suck and a stress suck because you can't check out. When you're running your own business, you're worried about it 24/7. If you've got a job, you can leave it at the office. And since you're saying you like your job, your boss is reasonably respectful, they're allowing you the work-life balance, as long as you continue to keep in your mind that centered how much work-life balance you want and not let the mission creep get you into too many 70-hour work weeks. Occasionally, we all have to do it. But if you generally keep that your priorities in order, I think you're far wiser to stay put. Because it's not like you're telling me you're craving self-employment. You're just thinking that might be a route to more time with your daughter. I don't buy it. Does that make sense?
Right. That does make sense. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you.
You're most welcome. Phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko. If you would like a workover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I was talking about what I call the un-MBA. I have helped many clients to either start a business successfully or to take a moribund business and to sometimes turn it around. Although Warren Buffett said that their turnarounds don't turn. It's very hard to do. It's usually wiser to cut your losses and go to something where you're better. Because once you've established a reputation, it's pretty tough. So I want to talk now about another kind of way to kind of violate the rules taught in MBA programs that nonetheless can help you be more likely to be successful as a one or few person small business. Business schools are always urging you to get big quickly. Their word they use is scalable. Alas, it is dangerous advice for small businesses and especially for individuals wanting to be self-employed. Yeah. If you ran that little one burrito store well and you it probably may not yield enough profit to earn big dollars. So you'd have to, though, go then and clone it in another location. But if you do that too much and you scale and you get it big and you have 13 locations, quality goes down, employee theft goes way up, there's problems, and your life is not your own anymore. Now you're going crazy. You're trying to manage 13 stores, 13 managers, buy for 13 stores, it becomes a nightmare. So I recommend for my clients the opposite. Keep it small. Don't be greedy. Your chance of going national, if you really look at most people who try to go national, yes, 1 in 100 get rich and are really happy about it. But a lot more either don't get rich, go broke, or they're successful but they're miserable. And that's a pretty heavy price to pay. So I think there's a sweet spot in staying small or relatively small. Another example of, I think, bad advice that MBA programs, business schools give. They're always focusing on high-status businesses. High-tech, biotech, medical devices, environmental technology, multinational corporations. I teach my clients the opposite. I want them to start low-status businesses. The grungier, the better. That way, you're competing with less capable business owners. I don't recall a single Stanford graduate or Harvard graduate or Berkeley graduate wanting to own a diesel repair shop or a mobile home park maintenance business or a installing or removing home for sale signs from, those 4x4s they stick in the lawn or running a chain of shoeshine stands or cleaning out basements and garages and installing cabinets there or rehabbing apartment buildings that the tenants ruined or selling out of a cart, selling soaps or scarves or knockoff designer purses or French soaps or coffee. Or I've never heard of one of those graduates placing or maintaining laundry machines in apartment buildings. But it's so much easier to compete in such low-status businesses. And I swear, after you succeed in those businesses and you have customers saying, thank you, wanting more of your business, do you have time to take my case? Do you have that? They love you and you feel great about that, even though it doesn't have high status. I've said many times on this radio show, status is the enemy of contentment. Status is the enemy of success. I want to share more of these, what really takes in the real world to start and succeed in a small business. But I do invite you to call. This is one of those rare times that we have spaces available. So feel free to call into KELW and Work with Marty Nemko. What I do is I offer free career advice to try to help you. Or, again, I've been talking about small businesses. So if you are either thinking about starting a business and want to run your idea by me, think of it as like Shark Tank. And I may be tough and I may be nice, but I'll be honest, that's for sure. Or if you're in a business and you're looking for some guidance as to whether you should shut the damn thing down or change it, tweak it, radically change it, or any kind of employment question, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko for a workover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Another area that business schools tend to focus on, which is, to me, greatly increases the risk of a small business failure, is they focus on intellectually meaty, complex businesses like the high tech and biotech I was mentioning. But of course, the more complex the business, the more they can go wrong. I teach my clients to choose a simple business, like those I just mentioned. Another thing, business schools urge, this is a classic business school phrase, choose a business with high barriers to entry. And they say, that's why it's tough for the competitors to enter the market. That's, again, that's really valid advice if you're a deep-pocketed corporation. But it's nearly suicidal if you're the typical cash-strapped entrepreneur. I recommend that most aspiring entrepreneurs start a business that requires little capital so you don't run out of money during the business's inevitable early misfires. Then if you have more money, fine, use your profits to clone the business or otherwise expand it. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hi, my name is Laura, and I moved here last summer from Olympia, Washington, where I was a licensed mental health counselor.
Yeah.
And for family issues, I've moved back to the Bay Area, and I'm just having such a difficult time getting my license transferred to California. And I'm just wondering sometimes, though I'm still have a practice in Olympia and go back there to work, and I can work in my field here, the hurdle is feeling so overwhelming. Sometimes I wonder if I should just give it up and do something completely different.
Well, let's briefly talk about this. If there was a goddess and the goddess were looking down upon you, would the goddess say you have a gift for helping a certain kind of client, or you're really kind of mediocre in all areas?
That's a great question. I'm actually very much sought after in the field that I have in Olympia, Washington. I feel like a small fish in a big pond here. I have specialization in trauma treatment, working with children that show conditions of sociopathology and children that have been adopted with severe behavioral issues. I have a lot of passion for it. I'm very good at it. Right now, what I'm struggling with is literally being allowed to work in
Got
this
it.
Field.
Do you know if your licensure allows you, you know, a significant percent and growing percentage of my clients are phone and Skype clients. They're all over the world. Do you know whether the rules of licensure apply to phone and Skype clients, and is that even realistic as an option? We're dealing with kids. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I really didn't thought about it. I mean, I do face-to-face. I've done, obviously, my work has me do court testimony, expert witness type of stuff. So a lot of that is face-to-face. I believe that the laws apply based on the state that you practice in. So they are state dictated. Since my residence is now California, I believe that I would fall under California regulation and law in terms of practicing out of a physical location in the state.
And where is the actual place you're running into a problem in the transfer of licensure?
Well, it's with the Board of Behavioral Science. I got my degree in 2004 and, again, had a private practice up in Washington State. And so now, because of the regulations, there's all of these new things that they're requiring. They're no longer grandfathering in somebody who has had a license. Even though I graduated from a California accredited institution, my practice was out of state. And so even though I've been licensed over 2 years and I've got a license in good standing, the requirements in order to get this, the process has taken more than 6 months at this point.
Okay.
And I keep sending documentation, I keep answering questions, and it's on and on and on.
I'm going to interrupt you because of time. Two things.
Of course.
Number one, I would go and actual read. Have you read very carefully, line by like a lawyer would, line by line, all of the rules associated with grandfathering, etc., so that you could see if there is perhaps some provision by which you can be granted some kind of a grandfather or other kind of exceptions. If you don't feel competent to do that, should you hire somebody who's an expert for an hour consultation? Either of those feel good, or are you more excited about spending the last few minutes on the radio here today talking about what career you might change to?
Well, I haven't looked at. I just followed the dictates of what's provided through the websites and the literature for the transition. And basically, what they say is you've got to go kind of an information tree. Have you graduated? Are you licensed? Blah 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 blah. And then basically, they say there's no option.
I can't undo that. So you sound like you've explored that. We have about 2 minutes left in the show.
Yeah.
I would like to spend it with you coming up with an alternative. Let's say there was an edict passed that you could no longer be this MFT person, this marriage and family child counselor, specialized in trauma, and you had to do something, quote, to use your term that you stated at the start of the interview, completely different at the start of our conversation. Give me a couple of clues about who you are, Laura the human being, that would give me something to work with to help you come up with a new career?
Well, I'm absolutely passionate about injustice, working with children, human trafficking. I've nearly completed a master's degree in criminal justice behavioral analysis. I'd love to work alongside law enforcement. I looked at just going ahead and jumping ship and trying to get into a job there, but I'm starting at the bottom. I think it's a word of mouth issue. I'm just kind of at a loss. I would love, I mean, this stuff keeps me up. I can work
just till the
night goes down in this field, working with protecting people, helping educate, helping to train, how to interface with victims that have experienced trauma, getting accurate interviews, and all of that. I just don't even know where to place
Okay. it. Well, there's obviously lots of places in the foster care system, in the adoption system, in child protective services. Have you done enough both internet research and informational interviews with people in those worlds to find out where you might be able to get in without having to be start at the poverty level?
Well, that's what I'm finding is that a lot of these jobs are requiring, you know, the civil service exam and then coming in at GS-1 or whatnot. I'm just not, what I've, in terms of talking to people that have those positions, which don't offer a lot of the flexibility, and if you're working at a state job, it doesn't offer you a lot of flexibility to be creative and to be industrious. I'd like to work in a consulting capacity, but I feel that I'm at a disadvantage if I can't get a license to do that.
Right. I would guess that there, you know, if you don't want to be the state employee and you want more flexibility, I would bet anything that there are consulting firms. I would imagine even that there are law firms that work on behalf of a family, whether it be the biological family or the adoptive family or somebody, where they're using consultants, where it's not necessarily licensure. I know that, for example, they use nurses and former retired medical malpractice law firms use nurses, retired nurses, whatever, to do some initial case review and recommendations. I'm wondering whether you might find some entities outside of the government system that utilize...
Oh, that's brilliant.
Okay. Well, I'll quit while I'm ahead. I don't get brilliant that often. Anyway, that's my thought for the day, and I thank you very much for calling Work with Marty Nemco.
Oh. Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And as I said, I wish you don't wait till the last second. Now we've got all these calls on the line, and the show is over. Please call early. Trust me. When I tell you to call early, it's for a reason. It's not for my health. Anyway, that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank Gary Gwilliam, my guest on the show, sharing really intimate personal things about the human side of what it's really like to be a trial lawyer. His book is called Getting a Winning Verdict in My Personal Life. As usual, I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do more workovers on callers, and I'll talk with Peter Himmler of Flatiron Communications on what's new and what works in marketing products and services today. It's wildly different and fascinating, even though you're not interested in marketing anything. Anyway, until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.